people have backgrounds and particular questions, and I would or interests, and I'd like to know that too. So I am Sharon Varallo. I grew up in Maryland, went to school in Virginia and North Carolina, PhD in Ohio, and I live in the Quad Cities now, where I've lived for the last 20 years. So I've been teaching at Augustana since 1998. And communication studies is my background. Now, I didn't know what that was as an undergrad. It is a very interdisciplinary field and is and can and really focuses in on messages and symbolic messages, messages of very often persuasion. So people study media, or they might study interpersonal communication, how we come to understand ourselves and others. They might study political communication. There's a whole array of ways that you can study comm studies. And at Augustana College, we have a very justice-centered curriculum that I'm very proud of. And part of my interest, part of how I came to study time in a during a sabbatical recently, really it was related to a number of things. I was interested in work-life balance, which, you know, a lot of folks are interested in because we don't seem to have a lot of it. I was interested in work-life balance at various points in my career. I was interested in parenting and mothering and sort of the ratcheting up of expectations across lots of different realms. And that has a time component, absolutely, right? So there are ways that we structure our lives that are based around things that we think should be for ourselves and others. Many of those things we learn. And so part of what I'm going to do today is talk about some of the ways that we learn about time structures differently in different cultures, and just to help us know, do we have options or not? Or what sorts of options do we have for how we structure our everyday? Right? So that's a little bit about me, Sharon, and could you really just briefly say your name and any special interests that you have in time? Who would like to start?
I'm actually a teacher and a choir director, so I think time management is a very useful way to understand just the value of time. And
yeah.
I was interested, just generally interested mm-hmm. in hearing more about it. So.
Thanks. Eric?
Interested in time for a long time. The concept of chronos,
yeah.
Clock time, calendar time, watch time, and
yeah.
Kairos, you know, that's timing, and how they intersect.
Awesome. Great.
And the topic of your talk has got my interest.
Good. Thanks.
I just think it's really interesting.
Cool. Thanks. How about back over here? Okay.
And sometimes I have trouble staying in the present because I'm too focused on what's next. Mm-hmm.
Found the subject interesting on the bulletin board looking at the schedule.
Thank you.
Families who've adopted internationally, and a lot of them are older children. And just kind of interested in thinking about the cultural things around time that can impact those relationships and families.
Lovely. Good.
My job requires a lot of strategic, like, budgeting and planning and scheduling 10, 20, 30, 40 years into the future. And so I'm trying to kind of get a grip on that and maybe see how other cultures might interpret that challenge.
Very interesting, yeah.
Faster.
Or not.
For 40 years on an American Indian reservation, and thought maybe I'd gain more insights into Indian time.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm currently studying for kind of pursuing master's in fine arts, and I'm interested in time as an abstract subject.
Cool.
Worrying about time.
Great.
Especially interested in our internalized sense of a beat. Hard to teach rhythm. Hard to teach and pitch. I don't know why.
Interesting.
Federal courts. And we do a lot of, on the bureaucratic side, we spend a lot of time doing things related to like the Speedy Trial Act and making sure that criminals have access to justice at related to time in a very codified manner.
Yes, that's really fascinating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I haven't gone to the phone time yet.
Yep.
I'm a choir director and a private voice teacher. And my whole life has been structured by every minute somebody's coming through the door, it's time for another lesson. And so it's slowed down, so it's a whole different feel in life. Mm-hmm. To have a husband.
Mm-hmm. Retirement.
I just take in all the education things that Paul is doing.
Aspects of time when future and past kind of blend into the present, and we are especially in the thin places, how that changes time.
Yes.
Is it my turn?
It's your turn.
Two things. First, I'm a nurse and I work in a hospital, so my time is very structured. Mm-hmm. Many things I do require to be done on time or at a certain time. But I also came just because I love hearing about things that I really have never heard about before or had no thought of before, and this just sounded so interesting.
Great, thanks for coming.
Minneapolis, but I'm with these St. Paul people.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I always used to, you know, when you raise a family, you're so organized and everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm retired now, and everybody's gone, and it's, you think you always have so much time, and you look at the clock, and oh my gosh, you have to fly out the door. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, you don't know where it goes, or
yeah,
how to. I'm not very good at managing it.
You're not alone. You're not alone. Okay, thank you. Some folks came in.
Virginia, Minnesota, and I'm interested in how my own life is shaped by my unrealized conception of time.
Ah, thank you for coming. Who else did I miss? Any? Oh.
But I have some intuitive sense of that.
Yes.
But I don't have any realities to marry to it. So.
Right. Great. Well, this is just the tiniest little start. But this, and who else did I miss over here? Yes.
And my interest probably is in the cultural aspect because I've lived in a couple of different cultures where the concept of time is much different than it is
yes.
here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's Filipino time or it's Hawaiian time for that matter, which is, and I'm interested at how our culture shapes that sense of time.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. We live in a culture where being crazy busy is prized as something that to be proud of. And so how do we find time for our own spiritual nurturing and development in the midst of this crazy, busy, over-the-media-focused society?
Absolutely. Anybody else I missed? This is very helpful to me because my session two is a lot of conversation, and it'll help me write some better questions if you plan to come to session two. And if you do and you want to catch me sort of in between, just please do. Please, you know, hunt me down. And I'll make a special group just to look at those particular questions. Because, for instance, I don't know anything about music and you know, that sort of time. But maybe there's somebody else who might want to connect up with you and talk about that. Similarly, for those who have backgrounds in religion, a lot of sort of emphasis on Kairos, on Chronos and Kairos. And I know a bit about that and could talk a little bit about that, but mostly what I'm going to do is talk about how we've learned what we've learned, how different cultures teach about time differently, and the sort of the attendant norms that go along with it. Because they impact us in every way. And sometimes we can't change something unless we know that it's an option to change. And some things we don't have option over. I don't have an option to have my employer say, you know, you can work part-time. You know, we don't have a graduated sense of how you can participate in society. It's almost like all or nothing, right? So in some ways. But in any event, this was helpful for me and I appreciate it. And so I'll get started a little bit and tell you a bit. There's some obvious ways that time is often studied. So you might, you know, think physics or anthropology, but time is studyable and influences music, lots of the things that you mentioned, but in tons of different disciplines. And the questions that they ask, the problems that they posit, are going to be really different. And so I've dabbled in some of these areas, but, you know, and many, many more. But business is really interested in time management, right? And economics as well in some ways. How leisure studies, how we have leisure, if we have leisure. I'm mostly focusing in on psychology and intercultural communication today. But again, ask me and we can have some discussion groups in other areas too if you like. So what I'm going to do here for the next little bit and is start with a little bit of a 5-minute video lesson from Philip Zimbardo. For those in psychology, the Philip Zimbardo has a little primer on time cultures that takes psychology as a starting point, and then we'll sort of go into how that how nations and cultures can be characterized by having certain time orientations. So psychology, psychological time, time perception, time orientations, and also cultural, moving into cultural time orientations, how we learn values as we're learning about how what we believe time is, right? And a prelude to how we might have options, which is where we're just going to discuss in session two. I'm very happy to have questions or conversation along the way, so please feel free to hop in. And we'll get going. Okay. So, first off, I'm going to show you. There's an RSA animate, little animated thing we're about to see that gives us a little background on psychology and time. And let me get out of here and get that open. But first, I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview because it goes really quickly. And one, so the way that he structures this, he's going to talk about three major psychological time orientations that are past, positive and negative, present, and future. Past, present, and future psychological time orientations, and then he'll move into culture. And so he goes really quickly through, just giving some little examples. And so I wanted to give you a preview so you can sort of follow along a little bit more easily. If you'd like to watch it again, we can watch it twice if you wish. But let's see what he has to say first.
So what we have discovered in 30 years of research, there's six main time zones that people live in. Two focus on the past, two on the present, and two on the future. Now, people who focus on the past either remember all the good old times, successes, happy birthdays, nostalgia. These are the people who keep the family record, the family books, who have the family rituals. There are other people who focus only on regret, only on failure, only on all the things that went wrong. So we call those focus past positive or past negative. There are two ways to be present oriented. The most obvious is to be hedonistic, that you live for pleasure and you avoid pain. You seek knowledge, you seek sensation. There are other people who are present oriented because they say, it doesn't pay the planet. My life is fated by my religion, fated by my poverty, fated by the conditions that I'm living under. Most of us are here because we are future-oriented, that we have learned to work rather than play, to resist temptation. But there's another way to be future-oriented. Depending on your religion, life begins after the death of the mortal body. To be future-oriented, you have to trust that when you make a decision about the future, it's going to carry out. If you have great inflation, you don't put money in a bank because you can't trust the future. If you have this instability in your family, adults can't keep their promises to you. The closer you are to the equator, the more present-oriented you are. The more you're in an environment where climate doesn't change, it gives you a set of imagining sameness rather than change. Protestants everywhere have higher gross national product than Catholic countries, in part because of the Protestant ethic, because of the notion that you work hard to succeed to demonstrate that you are God's chosen people. My family comes from Sicily, and in Italy there is a political movement called La Liga to cut Italy in half, have North Italy and South Italy, kind of just below Tuscany. The people in the North say, we do all the work. The people in the South are lazy, like children. They want to have babies, have three-hour dinners, etc. People in the South say, they're not Italian, they're German and Austrian, you know. They eat yogurt instead of pasta. They take their lunch in a paper bag. And in a recent election, the leader got 14% of the national vote. It turns out, it is accurate. We've done research to say people in the North tend to be, on a scale, much more future-oriented. People in the South tend to be more past-oriented or present hedonistic. And so my family is Sicilian, and I come from Sicily. I go back every year. I start an educational foundation. We send high school kids to college and set up computer labs. And I'm talking about some of this stuff, and a man comes up and says, I'm a poet. I live with words. It wasn't until I heard your talk that I realized there's no future tense verb in Sicilian dialect. I said, what do you mean? There was, is, there's no will be. He said, that's why nothing gets done. And I didn't realize it because we never planned. So again, here's how when you have a number of people who share a certain time perspective, that it does come to characterize a nation. The same way, if you have a Catholic nation where people tend to be present or past-oriented, rather than a Protestant nation where in general people tend to be more future-oriented, it affects you in very profound ways. So there's a wonderful book called The Geography of Time, and it's written by a dear friend of mine, Robert Levine, who's a social psychologist, and he actually literally went around the world doing wonderful experiments. He looks at what he calls the pace of life. See, time perspective is how people divide their own experience into partitions, time zone. Another kind of time orientation is your sense of duration. How much time has expired while you're sitting in a dentist's office before they start drilling? How much time has expired when you've been waiting in line? How much time has expired when you're having fun, or I said. So time duration is totally a function of whether you're bored, whether you're excited or not. And what he does is he shows that in different cultures, people have a different pace of life. And you do this very simply. You sit in a cafe, and you mark up 100 meters, and as people pass, you start a stopwatch. You see how fast people walk. You go to a post office, and on a piece of paper, you say, I'd like, you know, 3 pounds of you know, this postage or 10 euros, you see how long it takes. So there's a bunch of these measures. And it turns out you can identify cultures as different pace of life and now cities. And he shows in America you can rank 60 cities according high pace of life and low pace of life. And the ones that have the highest pace of life, men have the most coronary problems. That is, this becomes part of your whole way of life. We all begin life as present hedonists. All of us.
Just pause there because it's very full. It's very fast. And so you can see that there's all kinds of things to talk about. Let's just start with reactions, responses. We can talk about it if you want to see it again. We can see it again. What are some of your initial responses?
Mm-hmm. I thought he was wrong and missed a huge point in talking about death being future-oriented. Because if we are kind of be here now, Buddhist sense that we are spiritual beings presently incarnated in a physical body, then death is not future-oriented at all. Spirit is immortal.
I'm going to put this here. He does so much. I mean, so this is just the tiniest little bit, but I think you're absolutely right about the something missing when he talks about present orientation, present hedonistic, or present because this is what we have, right? And so maybe there's a notion of a Zen Buddhist notion of mindfulness,
yes,
which is very present oriented, which he doesn't speak of, but I think that it's in the model. That there is a way to be present-oriented that's it's not hedonistic at all. But it also doesn't fit the sentence that he said in here, right? But, and so this is definitely the briefest of, the barest of outlines, but I would agree with you that it is, but I think it's also in there. What else did you see, or do you want to?
Well, and if you think of time, though, I think there's two different ways to think of death. Is death is ongoing,
But if you think of death as the death event, that's future. And that's not in my present. Mm-hmm. So I understand what you're saying about contemplation of death in the present moment, you know. But there is a death event. Mm-hmm. That's in
that's later.
Yeah.
That's not.
I think that's what he's referring to.
Huh. Yes.
I thought it was fascinating that he linked denomination, Catholic or Protestant, with a particular time of year.
Mm-hmm.
But it also might be connected to economics, which he doesn't talk about. And a capitalist, I would posit maybe that the Protestant is also connected more with a capitalistic economic system, which also is a whole other driving force at times.
Yes. Absolutely, all of it. Right? So it's so interdisciplinary here. So what led to what is one question, right? Was it there? So he's left. I mean, there's so much stuff that's not in that little 5 minutes, but the interdisciplinary part of it, I think, is really fascinating to me, too. Yes?
And Protestants could also be the same places that industrialized first, and that has a very, very big impact on time because of industrialization. You have to manage it, and everything has value. And it has to be the same. 1 second has to have the same output or cost or the rest of the second, kind of no matter when the day it happens. And that, I think, fills into a lot of the modern Protestants are going to have a lot of industrialization, too.
And industrialization has a lot to do with sort of when you look at how we live our lives today and the metrics that we use for measuring. Chuck?
Yeah, I was taken by, I'm always interested in Einstein or the time changes depending on what you're doing. Pleasure or pain, right? Mm-hmm. And as an artist, the process of making art puts you into another side of your brain that actually time, in a way, goes away for a period of time. And then you come back into time here.
Yeah.
You just disappear into it.
And also, it's very interesting, I thought what you said about the equatorial countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's certainly, I think, is borne out by the places that I've been that have been warm climate-wise also as compared with more cold climate zones, that the time sense in the tropical country is kind of like not much.
It's less clock time oriented. It's less, the pace is different. And is it related then to geography and climate and, you know, and, right. So you see all the different disciplines that could play out in here. And the value orientation, and maybe there's a value orientation. Does it come before the time orientation or not? There, cultural anthropologists talk about cultural value systems, like is it a doing, a being, or a growing sort of center to a culture? Having a doing culture, which is very much mainstream America, right, has a more likely to have a future orientation, right? Being or growing. I mean, there are connections to how we will live our everyday, right? Based on if you think that it's a good person can be instead of do, or if does a good person need to grow, right? And so, again, all of these things sort of playing in.
You can go.
It's interesting that I'm just thinking about coming into this world as a baby.
Yeah.
You're in the present.
Yes.
But from then on, you start learning something, you know, and probably whatever is around you, but, you know, what your environment is, your parents or lack of parents. But yeah, and I thought about we go to Haiti and Africa and the industrialization of America and Europe, and the Haitians and the Africans live in the now, you know, they don't live in the future.
And there's pro and con to every system. There's positive and negative to every system. There are ways that people who operate from different time orientations judge each other negatively without understanding the time orientation from which others operate. And that's a very, and it's a, I mean, there, Edward T. Hall, an anthropologist, sort of the father of modern anthropology, some would say, but he has talked about time being the center of all cultures. Like, to really understand a culture, you really have to understand how they value and how they define time, right? And we often don't. I mean, I know that I am, I'm going to start to tell you about monochronic and polychronic time. There's a number of different ways that cultural anthropologists talk about time, right? And as I read about it, I know that I am I live by how I was raised. But what's important to me is to know that that's not the only way, and there are pro and con associated with my way. And so partly what I'm going to do is sort of uncover value systems and judgments. I want us to have a really non-judgmental conversation about it, hopefully, and not judge yourself either, because we use time to, you know, shouldn't you be doing this by now? Whether it's a life script of about this age, I should be doing this thing, about that age, I should be doing that thing, whether it's a life script or even an everyday. The notion of wasting time comes from a doing value orientation that is very monochronic, and well, it doesn't have to be monochronic, but so I'll get into some of those conflicts too.
I'm thinking about the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down.
Oh, yes, yeah, that's beautiful.
That is such a great example of the cultural conflicts that come from time, because the child has seizures. I think Cambodian or Hmong.
They're Hmong, mm-hmm.
And so the American doctors prescribe medicine to be taken at a certain time of the day, and they have absolutely no, the parents cannot do that, because that's totally antithetical to anything they believe or know about time. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole culture clash, trying to treat this child with a culture,
Western medicine,
cultural barrier, mm-hmm, that prevents them from understanding that.
Yeah. What sickness means and how we treat it and all of that. Tons of it.
Well, we've always been raised, you know, breakfast, lunch,
right,
dinner. You know, we know the time of day just by our stomachs. And actually, you look at the sun, oh, it must be about 2 o'clock, you know, 7:30 right now. You know, you can...
If you can do that, I think you're ahead of most people. I don't think most people can say, you know, can know what time it is basically by their environment. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but there's a lot of divorce from natural world when you have mechanical time, when all you have to do is look at your watch or your clock, but I interrupted you.
You can look at the yard and say, must be about 7:30.
Yeah.
And you look at your watch, and sure enough, 7:30.
Yeah.
You know, just the way the shadows are falling. And
yeah, yeah. That's a good observation, if you can.
Yeah, when I got up this morning, looked out and saw the shadows of the mountains going way up, and I go, oh, that's really, really great.
Yeah.
Really, really good to see that.
Yeah.
We don't get that at home.
Yeah. Neat.
What time was it?
6 o'clock.
Oh, no, I was sleeping.
What I'm interested in culturally, yes, is there's a perception in our culture that as you age, time goes faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know if that's a you know, kind of true cross-culturally, or if that's something we believe because we believe, you know, part of our culture.
I don't know the answer to that.
It'd be interesting.
And then it goes slow once you can't get up and you know,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah. You know, it just stands still,
right,
for people that can't.
Well, for me, that's true, because I had all these things along the years. I'll get to that when I get older.
Mm-hmm. But, and I have more time.
Yeah, I have more time. But I'm older and I don't have any time.
Right.
But I think that's an interesting, we believe that. And I think
the perception, right. And so the experience of time is not the same as a metric, right? And so whatever a minute is, a minute, an hour, a day, a week, and whatever sorts of metrics people have across cultures, it's not, that is almost irrelevant to how we feel about it or how we live it or how we experience it. So duration as he is, you know, and so how we measure time sort of is really quite limited because it isn't how we experience it necessarily, right? So this is going to, others want to say something before we move on? Yeah, go for it.
One thing about getting older and time changing is that the more experienced there are something, the faster it goes because our brain doesn't have to do as much work to stimuli. So if you go walking somewhere for the first time, you don't know where you are. You have to look out for landmarks or things to find. But as you go there more and more, you're familiar with it. So your brain doesn't have to check for as many cues. And so you have a sense of moving through that place much quicker than you would the first time. And that kind of applies to a lot of things. The more you do stuff, the quicker it can seem to you just to do that task.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it takes so long to get someplace and then turn around and go home.
And if you have a doing orientation or a task orientation, maybe you're focusing in on the end of it, right? And you're less likely to pay attention to the things that are about the journey itself or that are about, right, the middle parts or the beginning parts. And so, but if you have a present orientation, it might affect how you see where you are, right? How you enjoy your meal or not. Or, you know, what are mealtimes for? Are they for sustaining your body? Are they for conversation? And so anyone who's traveled and has had, you know, different experiences in different restaurants regarding, like, what a mealtime is supposed to be for, is that a break time that's supposed to be slow? It's about company, or it's about, you know, communion. And you know, it's and so there's all of these little things that play into this one central notion about time. Yes?
I'm not a musician, but time is very, music is very structured, time-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on the flip side of that, you can lose yourself in it, kind of like art, as you were saying earlier. But even if you're not a musician, just listening to music, you can just kind of lose the sense of time.
And then some people don't consider the other ways of time.
Right.
I mean, if it's something dear to you, that's what you want to do, is, you know, listen to that wonderful music, or if you're a painter, just paint and paint.
Yeah.
It brings you joy. So you don't, you let the time go.
And maybe if you have a monochronic sort of fast-paced life and you get joy from that, that's awesome. Right? I like to make lists and I like to check things off. And I'm like, I get some pleasure out of that. That's cool. But if you know, like, where is the joy for you? And is there a link to how you think you should spend your days? Right? What was I going to say? So many things. I just lost my train. It'll come back to me. But for those who are interested in really creative imaginings about time, Einstein's Dreams is a book by Alan Lightman, who's a physicist. And it's a work of fiction, but Einstein is a character in it, and every chapter he reimagines time. So time might be sticky in one chapter, or time goes faster the higher you are versus the lower that you are, and like people live on a mountain, and if you're really creatively interested in imagining time differently, then Einstein's Dreams is a book that I should have put on my recommended list as well. I had my students read that because we were trying to dabble in different disciplines. I taught a time class here at Holden. I don't remember if I mentioned that. And back on my busy campus, when I teach intercultural communication there, I give my students a 2 hours of doing nothing assignment. 2 hours of doing nothing productive. And sometimes they flash me daggers. What do you mean? 2 hours in a row? Right? They do. I mean, like, it's hard for some folks to just slow down. And I literally one time had a student come to me and say, I could not slow down. And I realized I need help slowing down. I mean, there were a few crises that happened as a result of that. Little 2 hours of doing nothing, but what is wasting time? when I ask them, when you say wasting time, what are you doing? Sleeping? What? I mean, neuroscientists know that sleeping, like, you need to sleep to learn. You need to sleep to, I mean, for anything, you need sleep, right? And so, but is that wasting time? Because it seems like it's not productive, right?
I read an article by a rafting guide that does 7 and 10 day trips on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. And he doesn't allow people to take any kind of chronometric device, no watch, no nothing. And he said almost everyone reports it takes 5 days with no watches or clock to stop wondering what time is it. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
And he said that's really consistent across all the hundreds of people. That's the average. It takes 5 days to stop thinking about what time is it.
Yeah. That's super fascinating. That is absolutely fascinating. And it makes sense, and it like sort of anecdotally, when you talk about how long it takes people to sort of relax when they get into their vacation, like if they're, you know, like they're so wound up, right? And right.
Yeah.
And when we get home, like, are we bound up by how do we have to have that pace? I mean, we might have to. There are times in our lives when we can't slow down. But so to get into pace, so Chuck will have the last word, and then I'll move on.
Yeah, I always think the thing on that.
Yeah. Like physiologically, your body responds. Heart rates, right? Slow down.
Even the electrolytes and, you know, the ground has minerals and.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah, it's interesting that everything has a frequency. Rocks and any has a frequency that could be measured. It's a physiological,
neat,
scientific. No.
I did not know.
Add
that to my lectures. Oh, there's so much to add. I mean, there's no, there. I mean, that. That little blip is so fast. Did anybody want to see it again, or shall we move on? I see. Move on. Okay. I can share it. I can share that with anybody who wants to watch it again at another time. I'm going to repeat this on Thursday, if anybody will be here as well. So again, so the past, just to let you know that people do work with models, and there are others who say that there's a fourth way of imagining psychological time, and so more of an analytical timeline approach, that where if a person is not just past, present, and future, but perhaps all of them a little bit oriented, where you might learn from the past and it affects your present day and what you imagine into the future. And so it's a timeline approach, and that shows up in some literature on psychological time orientations, although not all. Now when we get into how cultural anthropologists or intercultural communication scholars talk about time. Intercultural communication is an interactive discipline. So if I were to say cross-cultural, then that would mean cross-cultural communication. Let's say family conflict. Let's say family conflict in Germany, if we're looking at culture as nation, which I don't always do, right? Let's say a cross-cultural would be how families in Germany, you know, handle conflict, how families in the United States or in Haiti or in, you know, Japan handle conflict. They're not interacting with each other, but you can compare, right? And so some of this work is cross-cultural comparisons of time, and some of it is intercultural, where persons are interacting from different cultures, and so that's how I'm defining cross-cultural versus intercultural. So intercultural communication, then, is when people who are operating from different time cultures interact with each other. And because it's so deeply rooted in and so important to how we handle our lives, that can sometimes result in conflict, right? And so interestingly, in a lot of the literature, there's two major cultural time systems called monochronic and polychronic. So I'm going to talk about them both, and then we're going to mess with it. Usually what I do in my classes is sort of talk about the classic literature and then take a different lens to it. And what is missing, and what else can we learn from it, right? Anybody familiar with monochronic and polychronic time? So chronemics is the study of time. And monochronic and polychronic time are the two major cultural time options. Monochronic is more clock-driven, clock time. It's, as I say here, arbitrary, one thing at a time, a monochronic time orientation. There's a time for things. So it's lunchtime. Somebody said, I think it was Kay, said, you know, there's, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Sometimes we know that by being hungry. But has anyone in here ever eaten when they weren't hungry, but because it was time? Like, it's time. It's time to eat, so eat, right? That's very monochronic, and in a sense, that's arbitrary, right? The clock tells you when to do things. And so the clock is not the same as time. And this is where we often get it really, really wrong in a monochronic culture, right? So it's clock-driven and a sort of more of a singular focus. It's a linear, the rationality is a linear rationality of making sense, like analytical past, present, future. There's a chronology, right? And that's a monochronic ethic and logic. Okay. Polychronic is less, it's more circular, it's more people-driven, it's more event-driven, it's more organic in the sense of you wouldn't necessarily think to eat because it's time to eat. You would eat when you were hungry, right? Or the conversation that I'm having with Monica. I'm having a conversation with Monica, and our conversation is done when our conversation is supposed to be done, not when the clock says I'm supposed to be somewhere else, right? And so things start when they're supposed to start. Things end when it makes sense for those things to end. And so the logic is different. What is respectful of other people is different. And you can easily misjudge people from a different time culture by operating within one rule book, right? And so often students who study abroad, students who travel abroad, right? I like to talk a lot about time, and it's not like you can easily break out of your time system, right? You might still want to do things the way that you do them, but it's an exercise, I think, that's very important for us all to do, is to just sort of recognize, okay, is it disrespectful that you're talking to me and somebody, you know, how do I say it? If I have a 1:15 appointment and I have somebody that I'm talking to right now and we're not done, is it disrespectful to that other person to keep talking? Disrespect is a meaning, right? And so if we get into actual behavior, what I'm doing is talking with you, and I'm talking with you till I'm done talking with you. There are ways we can say you're wrong, you're disrespectful, you don't value my time, you don't what have you, right? That might miss it, that might miss something. It doesn't mean I have to operate on a different time system, but it does mean that it's maybe not necessarily that people are rude or that they don't work hard or that they don't, you know, if my meal comes over 2 hours instead of, you know, 30 minutes or what have you. So multiple foci when it says this, in polychronic time, we might do multiple things at once. It's a little bit less, and I'm not talking about multitasking. You can be monochronic and multitask, right? But truly, people-driven, like, there are some folks who can have multiple conversations at once. I mean, literally, they can. And I cannot have multiple conversations at once. I just can't. I can't operate like that. So comments or thoughts on this so far?
Time for lunch.
Time for lunch. It is, exactly. I know the bell. And I'm not offended. So if you need to go do what you need, that's cool. That's fine. But the bell, I think time at Holden is fascinating because I think Holden is successful, I think, because it operates like there's multiple time cultures inside Holden. it's super structured, but it's also allows for really deep and deep conversations and meaningful action. I don't know. I honestly believe that people inhabit multiple time cultures here in a way that I don't see in very many places at all. And part of it is what I experienced when I was here the first time, and everybody has their own experience, but I experienced a very non-judgmental place. When I came back from my very first experience at Holden for 7 weeks with 18 students and two other faculty members, I felt like this was the most non-judgmental place I'd ever been. And so much of our lives, we have expectations, and you should do this, and I should do that, and like things that we feel for ourselves that are in some part rooted in productivity, or that are rooted in, you know, some idea that it, if you go back far enough, might be about a doing orientation or about a particular conception of time. So, but the bell did ring, and it can't unring. Like, it rang. So, and I'm going to still keep going, but it's okay if you leave. Go ahead.
On the topic of you're having a conversation with someone, and you feel like there is a place you need to be, but you're worried about disrespect of having to leave in that certain situation if you're not done talking to them. And then there's the other part of it, too, where you feel like, well, you have an appointment that you've made to,
right.
And that to be respectful of their time, of that appointment that you're going to.
Yeah.
Either way, you feel like you could be unintentionally
rude, or
someone feel bad.
Right.
If you were to stay in the present and continue enjoying that conversation, you know.
It's a shared norm. What's the shared norm for where you are? So when my students go to study in Spain, classes do not start on time. On time, they don't start on clock time in Spain, in Sevilla, when my, you know, several of my students, or any lots of other places too. In some places, the clock time is like a suggestion around then, but it's not like it's supposed to start right now. And so as a result, there's not shaming when people are later than that suggested sort of time. And people understand if you're not late. So it's not, so it's looser in its, I mean, like, I'm 2 minutes late to class, like, forget it. My students are like, you're wasting our time. I try really hard not to be late because, no, we're very clock time oriented culture. And it is, it can be seen as disrespectful, right? But if it's truly polychronic, then it's not.
But think about waiting for a doctor's appointment.
Yeah, yeah. And there's power there.
And, you know, right. I think about one doctor I had who was so wonderful, and the fact that I didn't mind waiting, and the reason I didn't mind waiting was I knew that that person that was seeing her right now needed her time.
Yeah, that's kind of you.
And if I needed her time, I would have that time.
Yeah.
So I don't always feel that way with doctor's appointments, and I oftentimes feel like, you know, they're not being respectful of our time because we're sitting here. But there's that other side of that, too.
Yeah.
Something about monochromatic time that's very zero-sum, where if you only have one
clock
and the minutes are always the same, if I'm supposed to be at lunch right now but I want to spend 5 minutes with you, I'm taking that time away from
that's
other
right.
people. But if it's polychromatic, there's kind of a lunch doesn't have a fixed time, so it's not going to start till we're all there. And it's a little more, you can be free, but even if we want to be friendly, monochromatic time makes it really, really hard to bend the rules. There's always kind of a, you're breaking the rules. If you're not, you know, following the doctor appointment schedule, even if you need that time.
There's a morality, and that's like a little bit later on. There's a way that we have built in ways, ideas about what good people do. That's centered in some of this stuff too, and good students learn very, you know, I mean, people who do well in school tend to be, you know, future oriented or organize their time in particular ways. And is that what learning is or education is? I mean, no, not necessarily, but it certainly helps you to be a citizen in this country and culture, to learn those and to see those as skills. And so what I like for us to do is say, what really good skills do I have? And what skills do I need to work on? And can I work on Can I try it out? Because there's skills associated with both of these. What is really hard, I think, is when we use these to shame ourselves or others, right? And so let me move on a little bit. And here's where it's often, when I say it's posited as a dichotomy in a lot of the texts. And, whoops, I had a little picture of a cat there. I'll find my cat in a minute. What's a problem with a dichotomy? There's a whole host of these. I'm just going to show you a couple. There's two slides. With interpersonal relationships and monochronic interpersonal relationships are subordinate to a schedule. So if you have a schedule and you're my friend, you get it that I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I have to be somewhere at noon, right? And that's cool, and everybody gets it in monochronic culture, right? In polychronic cultures, the schedule is more subordinate to your relationships. And so if you have a friend who needs you, or if you have, like, that's just what people do in that culture, right? Again, there's pro and con to each of these, and I'm going to highlight the ways that that monochronic learners often learn to denigrate polychronic learners. But so first I'll give you some of these, those. I love to have my schedule. I sort of obsessively go to the board and be like, what's next? What's next at Holden Village? And I love to see what all the possibilities are. And that works for me, right? And your schedule can coordinate your activity. And it's under polychronic, it's more fluid. So your interpersonal relationships are more what coordinate your activities. And so there's more sort of I can't think of the word, but you're more embedded in each other. So it's individualistic. Less individualistic in a way, more sort of bound up in each other, right? Appointment times and monochronic thinking are rigid, more flexible. With polychronic, as I said, more like a suggestion. What breaks mean, what personal time means, is it rude, you know, when you know you're on a break, can you be interrupted? Breaks are sacrosanct in monochronic time. That is, you know, there's more of a barrier there. Okay. There's lots more. I'll just give you. Do I want to say? There's one of these that I'll talk about here. We can talk about any that you like to, but let's take a look at task measurement. Monochronic societies, we really tend to focus on how much time is this going to take, right? And we punch in, and we do a lot of things. Time literally is money, right? When I work with World Relief, which is a refugee resettlement agency in the Quad Cities, and a lot of the cultural orientation training for newcomers to the United States is very much about one of the most important things you need to know is the alarm clock, and time is money in America. And you know, but the output is very often in time. In polychronic cultures, there's less of an emphasis on how long something should take or would take, and it's more, the focus is on the goal itself. So there's very often relationship building in business deals, right? And it's not just about the task, it's about getting to know one another. And so anyone who's taken basic organizational communication and business fields has learned about that, right? I'll just move on a bit. Okay. What's the matter with a dichotomy? A dichotomy, you say? So who cares? What's wrong with dichotomies?
Either or exist at the
same time? Absolutely, they can often exist at the same time, especially, and so sometimes it positions us as either you're this or you're that. But is it? And sometimes when it's either this or that, there's one of those sides that's positioned as better, right? Not always, but sometimes. And so critical thinking, yay! So we have to take a critical thinking lens to what we learn about time and time systems. Because when you take a critical lens to something, so most of this is social science, right? So a lot of intercultural communication is social scientific, where cultures are looked at as variables. Like, you know, And we know that things can be much, much more complex than that. And so taking a critical lens to what we learn about monochronic and polychronic time, I'm just going to show you some of the ways that we have learned that there have been subtle or not so subtle messages about what's good, right? And that we sometimes structure our lives by. So we'll take a critical lens to some. And this is something that I did on my sabbatical. I read a lot about time, and then I looked at how time is taught in cultural in textbooks of intercultural communication, and how it's taught that we're socialized into time norms and value norms, and how Western time has been somewhat normalized. And so there's problematic implications. I'm going to give you some examples, and I'll read. This is a 2009 textbook. The way people use time can result in misunderstandings because people from monochronic time cultures are used to carrying out one conversation at a time, whereas people who use polychronic time carry several conversations simultaneously, which confuses and frustrates the users of monochronic time. What's the problem?
Only one person's supposed to speak over
that. Yeah. Oh, well, that's true. That's interesting. Yeah.
That's an implied bias in that.
It implies monochronic people get frustrated with polychronic people who, like, can't, like, have one conversation begin and end and can't be there on time. And so the frustration, there's always this frustration built in. When we look at intercultural communication, it says, only monochronic persons are posited as frustrated. Right. Is it possible to be frustrated by someone who, you know, is monochronic? Absolutely. But not in the textbooks. You never see that in the textbooks. There's no parallel treatment of potential confusion or frustration. So there's this assumed monochronic normalcy in not just the textbooks, but in the world, like in the United States at least, right? And so there's this assumed monochronic normalcy. To many Asians, time is more of a relational issue rather than a clock time issue. And in some less developed countries, life moves to the rhythms of nature, the day, the seasons, the year. Such human interventions as seconds, minutes, hours, and weeks have no real meaning. What's the problem?
All countries forgot how to look outside and tell the time of day.
You could absolutely reframe it, and that's what I do. So I'm going to do flip the bias in just a minute. But, yeah, Chuck?
I'm curious about the phrase less developed countries.
Yes.
What does that mean? Right? I mean,
right.
Nature,
exactly. And that is, and the way that we organize time, like, that's absolutely in a lot of the textbooks still in 2018, right? And so, a problem, polychronic persons, right, are assumed as sort of less developed or less organizationally developed. They don't understand mechanized time, right? Monochronic persons are not positioned as ignorant of anything. What you just did is exactly what I like to do. Let's flip it, right? So they're not held accountable for what they ostensibly do not know or what they or how they do not act. So, for example, if we flip to the bias, what's your name? Raymond? What Raymond just did, he was at. A parallel sentence might read, if we were to flip the bias, monochronic persons, such as Americans, move to the beat of a mechanical time. Monochronic persons are not in tune with nature. Such natural happenings as the sun rising or birds migrating or normal biological aging have no real meaning. I mean, that's kind of wrong, right? But that's exactly what is happening in a lot of the ways that we talk about time, that we teach about time. I just went backwards there so you could see it. But so such human interventions as seconds, minutes, hours, and weeks have no real meaning. That is not true. Neither is it true that monochronic persons are not necessarily in touch with nature, right? This is absolutely not true, but you see this all the time when people judge themselves or each other based on inaccurate understandings of what time can mean. So that was in a textbook, and I have tons of examples of these. And this is very, so mechanical time is often used at, in like the words less developed and stuff like that, like crazy talk, right? But it's, anyway.
Well, do you think they mean less developed countries, like you see on National Geographic, you know, because they do everything according to nature, and they don't know what time it is.
But they do.
Their routines and their...
Well, we all have a way of understanding what time is, and so... But the clock is something different, and everybody have. I mean, clocks are all over the world, right? Clocks, watches, but what it means and what significance it has varies. And very often, monochronic persons think this is time, but it's not. And so, but the it's hard to break out of that, and it's even we are taught that because we're taught. I'll give you a couple more. We'll do some more flip the biases, okay? And then I can do this again. So for Americans, time is a valuable commodity, something to be measured and used wisely. Americans manage their lives according to schedules, which are often divided into hourly, daily, weekly, monthly, and even yearly segments. Deadlines and due dates are a constant reminder of when projects must be completed. This is in contrast to other cultures, such as Mexico, where it is considered important to get to know the other person before initiating business discussions. This is in contrast. Time is valuable to Americans, they say, right? Time is something to be measured, to be used wisely, to be organized, to be managed, right? There's also a control dimension. You manage your time as if you have control, right? And then in... when it says this is in contrast to other cultures that don't value time, how can you flip that bias? We can say, well, a problem, certain kinds of agency are valuable to Americans. For shorthand, we say time is valued. But I'm going to suggest whenever we use this, whenever we try to say, if time is time valued, or do you don't value your time, or I'm try to substitute something else. What is it? Is it efficiency? Is it productivity? What is it that we're valuing if we don't say it's time we're valuing? Right? So certain kinds of agency are valuable to Americans. For shorthand, we say time. But really, we support that claim with evidence of a task orientation. If I value time and therefore I work really hard on this task, it's not valuing time, it's valuing the task. And so this is where we lose, you know, sort of, we're misnaming what we're doing.
Your bias is betraying the word wiser, because that which isn't wise is foolish.
Yes.
That's the flip.
And so, quote unquote, less developed, less clock time focused perhaps, perhaps more developed, perhaps more focused on some other things. Right? So again, taking out time and substituting what it is that we really value. Persons from such... I'm sorry?
One of the things that work with being a nurse that you see, like if you're a nurse, the basic nurse that takes care of patients, you clock in and you work from 7:30 to 3:30. And
yeah.
Your job and everything else. But then you have managers. And I mean, it's not... It's, it works out okay, but you have managers and they have tasks to do. Mm-hmm. Because, and they're not on the floor taking care of a patient. They're in their office doing their tasks. And so some days they work from 7 to 5:30 to get their tasks done. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they work from 7 to 1 and then go home because their task is done and they no longer have to be there because you're, you know. And so you have people doing different jobs but working side by side, but some are working mono.
Yes.
And some are working poly.
That's very interesting. And I yeah.
I have a nursing sort of related anecdote to that. I don't know if you remember this, but one time when I was younger, I used to get sick in a way that I would throw up and throw up and throw up and wouldn't be able to stop. And one time we went to the hospital, and I got to the point where I was kind of getting better, and I kept falling asleep. And the nurses were on a schedule, and so they were told to check on me like every hour, and they would wake me up. And when I would wake up, I would throw up. Finally, my dad said, please stop waking her up.
Yeah.
The whole point is for her to stop throwing up, and every time you wake her up, she throws up. So can we not do this schedule anymore because it's making things worse?
Yeah.
And it's those two orientations. The sleep was
succeeding in creating the environment that we were looking for, and the nurses were on this every hour, she must be poked.
Right, right. And that's good healthcare, because I'm checking, right?
Right.
And so
I'm doing my job right.
I'm doing my job right, because like, how can I not do that? Yeah.
I just wanted to follow up on what you were saying about the managers and the nurses, where I think our division between hourly workers and salary workers shows that we really need to put a lot of effort into trying to make monochromatic time work, that we couldn't have a fully monochromatic time system that would fall apart. And so we have people who have built-in professional roles that say, you're not on monochromatic time, we need you to work on polychromatic time so you can be around after hours to fix a problem that other people might have.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, really hard system to maintain. And to give another example, I work with ships, like cargo ships, and they spend about $85 a minute to park them at a dock. So they're very, very oriented to monochromatic time, but everybody who serves those ships doesn't get any kind of set schedule. You work whenever the ship needs you, and you get to go home whenever the ship doesn't need you. And so those companies work on a very polychromatic time because they need their
task orientation.
It's interesting to think about monochromatic and polychromatic in terms of culture with mental health.
Yes. Say more.
How that, you know, is the mental health on monochromatic time higher than it is in polychromatic time? And how would that be measured? You know, how could you measure that?
They did imply in the little animation that the strict clock focused people have a higher rate of
coronary to heart disease.
Stress
related illnesses are higher
interesting
in
to think
pace.
Of it in another way, in terms of mental health, too.
Yeah, it is.
Well, in terms of that, too, is, you know, we're born into polychromatic and we learn the monochromatic.
That's Philip Zimbardo later in that animated sketch says his belief is that schools are intended to sort of tame the wild beasts of, you know, little children and to make them into usually more future-oriented, sometimes more past-oriented. So that was one of Zimbardo's points.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of struggling with, it sounds like the way these are described, Americans are consistently the same. And I can
right.
Good. They are very much
you are exactly right.
So, is there some talk about a spectrum?
There is.
You know, a spectrum of polychromatic and
chronic. Chronic, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. And yes, and you are exactly right. And that's another way that sort of social science has, in looking at variables and sort of more discrete categories, I think is led us astray. And I think that there's skill development. So I absolutely believe there's more than two ways of having, you know, major groups of people responding to time. And but these are the most common that you will find across the board in the research.
It sounds like so much of a generalization.
It's so generalized. And you're exactly right. America, many, many countries are very multicultural countries, and a lot of those, and a lot at the center, you can be polychronic American, right, and a monochronic Hawaiian person, right, or whatever. I mean, Hawaiian is American. See that? But there we go. So that's an example of polychronic nation doesn't is not the best way to talk about a culture, and so in a lot of textbooks it does. Country is considered like a nation as a culture, and you're exactly right. It's that's way too simplistic. There are norms, though, and the prevailing norm in the United States of America is very monochronic.
We have schools.
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We have, and there's punishments. I mean, people who sort of break the rules sort of kind of get a little punished, and you know, when they're in different operating under different time systems.
New York's different than LA.
Yes, yeah, and regions as well, right?
And Miami.
Yeah. So I'm going to do a little more flip the bias. So a parallel sentence. I'm going to read another one of these sentences. What if the bias was otherwise, right? And this parallel sentence might say, the continuing value Mexicans place on time is illustrated by corporate practices in which persons doing business spend much time getting to know each other, building relationships that are intended to and may last well beyond the immediate deal. In contrast to America, business people in Mexico value time. Americans value the bottom line. I made that up. I'm trying to just say, like, look at how the bias is in here, right? And I have lots and lots of different examples, right? French do not share the American sense of urgency to accomplish tasks, right? You can try it. Americans do not share the French sense of joie de vivre, right? Whatever. I mean, we can use it to punish each other over and over and over again, right? The Americans simply do not share the French preoccupation with doing the task well. I mean, we can do this, and this is pretty common, right? We could do it for days, but you get the idea.
However, it is also, if you're living internationally or even traveling internationally, it's really important to know what those cultural norms are.
Yes, it is.
Because mm-hmm. you're not a good... value statement, but you're not a very good ambassador or medium if you don't recognize that, know about it, and recognize mm-hmm. it and value it.
Yeah. Flexibility is critical to intercultural competence. To be good at being an intercultural, you know, communicator. And not understanding. Sometimes, like, okay, I thought it was supposed to start, and I'm here, and nobody's here. Can you handle that, right? Can you handle that is a skill, and that's a skill that could come with practice, right? Knowing this can help. It doesn't mean your body won't respond with frustration. It's kind of like, you know, space norms are the same way. Just because somebody has a closer space norm and their regular mode of operation is standing much closer to me, it doesn't mean my head's not going to go, ah, if somebody's standing this close to me. But it means I'm not going to judge you in the same kind of way, right? That I won't necessarily have to say, you're being rude or this is wrong. Right? I can just be like, oh my gosh. This is very uncomfortable for me, and it's okay. So we could do this for days, right? But you get the idea. So we have about 15 minutes. I've got a couple more things I can talk about. But how are you doing in terms of, you need to stand and stretch? Are you good? Doing okay? Okay. I'll just do a few more things. How did we get here? So normalization of monochronic clock time virtues. I'll go a little bit quickly through here. And for those who are religion scholars, I mean, you have all have different backgrounds, and I'd love to hear more about what you know about all of this. But at least some scholars have suggested that the idea of time that's dominated public life in the West was not indigenous. That it came to Europe with Christianity. And that two ideas about time had long roots in Jewish and Christian tradition. The origin of time in creation. That is, on the seventh day, God created not a sacred place, but a sacred time. And the end of time and a day of judgment. And so at least some folks have suggested that the linearity of monochronic time derives from the geometric connection between these endpoints. And so that we see that when you monochronic persons see time, right, in this sort of line, right? Whereas there are more spiral metaphors and visuals in polychronic and other sorts of and other sorts of creation stories, right? Or the ways that we understand this would be less linear, but there's a rationality that goes with a linear approach, and that what passes for the natural rationality of linear time is in fact a set of cultural claims about the efficacy of law and specific technologies of social ordering. There is an order, there is a social order, there's a social structure that comes with a linear sense of time. There's a discipline that comes with a linear sense of time. The notion of a watch, when managers would keep watch on employees after, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, right? And so this is a disciplining function that sort of takes root in social ordering. Yes?
How has that changed now that we have iPhones where
I think there are dissertations to be written about that, and there are, and people have talked about digital time and electronic time and sort of like having technologies at the center of the conversation about what now new times might mean. And I don't know. What are your thoughts on it? Yeah.
I don't know either. Yeah.
Yeah.
Second, versus, well, I have a watch that's a little bit slow, and I
yeah.
How is right. that brain going to
get into a mile? Yeah. Oh, sorry. There's so much good stuff to read on this. There's a, if you're interested in language, there's a book called When Languages Die, and there's a chapter on how time systems and time, you know, and operations, calendars and timekeeping systems and metrics are rooted in languages. And so when languages die, when smaller languages are no longer passed on, there's whole ways of imagining time that might be gone, right? But there's the actual clock, and then there's the experience of it, which is different, right? The meaning of it, how we order use it to order our lives or not. And so human interaction with it is still really widely variable, right? Even as we might all know exactly what time it is. I love it that you have a little bit of a slow watch, because there is also some research on public timepieces. Public timepieces, the research says the more accurate they are, the more the sort of like the higher pace of life and the more sort of the coronary problems that were talked about in this video, the more accurate, the higher the risks of, the higher the heart attack incidences there are, right? And so if you have public timepieces that are a little wacky and always a little bit off, I always take great comfort in that. I just think, ah, we're a little more relaxed. You're like, that's okay. That's better for us. It's better for health. Well, even then, like, if you, you're like, eh, you know, if you, it's sort of there, I think that that makes me smile. Unless you want to catch a train. Right. Right.
When time, you're doing something where time is so important to your structure of your life, like missing a train.
Right.
Or a plane.
Right. Da-da. Or the ferry. That's right. And then you're like, I've wasted hours. And maybe you can just, right, relax. But certainly standard railway time, there are those who know about industrialization and the furnishing of the correct time, making sure that everybody knows the correct time, bringing us into the furnishing of quote-unquote correct time is educational in its nature, for it inculcates in the masses a certain precision in doing the daily work of life, which conduces perhaps to a sounder morality. Again, I know this was quoted in Levine, but one of the first time stations in Pennsylvania that was trying to get the railroads on the same schedule, right? Because each little village used to have its own time system, so it could be 12:05 over here and 11:40 over there, and you know, and so just to bring everybody together, right? But again, this moral claim, And you see it all the time. Like, oh my gosh, I've overslept. You're late, you know, you're late, something's bad, you're not doing it right. The ways that we discipline based on, right, tardiness, right? Ah, I love that. So I'm not gonna go into time use studies, but the way that we measure it in different disciplines as well, there's something about productivity in like, are you doing, how do we spend our time? There's a lot of fascination with how much time do people spend on this, on that, on that, on that. And time use studies, time diaries that people keep as a kind of a measurement is yet another indication that we can compare our lives to. Are we doing the things that everybody else is doing, like in time use studies, right? I think this just absolutely does not at all get at what the experience is like of living a day. And even though I think this stuff is interesting and important, the meaning is just, there's no meaning in here for me at all. Right?
Leisure and sports is 2 hours with people with children
and working. Data, this is... This is Bureau of Labor Statistics, American Time Use Survey, where it looks like there's some rationality here. There's something here that just makes it look so neat. And, 7.6 hours of sleep, 8.8 working activities, leisure and sports, ages 25 to 54, who lived in households with children under 18. No, it doesn't. What about, and then they break it up, like, what about college students? Look, they sleep an hour more. And their leisure and sports. Like, who feels like they have I don't think any of my students feel like they have 3.8 hours of leisure or sports. And I'm going to go back up. Any adults that you know who feel like daily they have hours of leisure. But if you put in a time diary how you've spent your time, it will count it like that. If you're not doing something like obviously productive, then you'll count it as leisure. Is that how you experience it? No. I mean, I know incredibly stressed out people who are doing their darndest, who are trying their hardest, and they're working hard, and they're taking care of people, and there's not a lot of way to put meaning into that. And look at eating and drinking, 1 hour total for a day. I mean, that does tell us something. But that makes me a little sad, right? But only because I don't think eating and drinking is just about eating and drinking. I mean, ideally, you know. So time use studies measure actual time. On my second session, we're going to talk about time scarcity, psychological time, a little bit more with psychological time. And the notion of time scarcity is just like any resource that's vital. If you feel like you don't have enough of it, you get panicked. If there's a scarcity of food or air or something we need to live, it's panicking. People often feel like that when they feel like they don't have enough time. And so this Tim Kasser from Knox College and a bunch of other folks, John DeGraff, who apparently comes to the village a lot, has studied time. I'm going to talk a little bit more about his stuff on Thursday as well. But time scarcity is this notion of just constantly feeling like we don't have enough. And we're going to spend most of that time in discussion groups, sort of pushing against and trying to see, like, do we or don't we? Like, where do we have option and where don't we? And what are some things that we can learn and teach with each other about options that we can have to sort of overcome this notion of time scarcity, because we have the time that we have. It's not more or less than we ever will have. So what then do we do? Thank you so much. What are your...